From Birmingham, Alabama, this is ARC Stories Radio. The stories you're about to hear are true, personal, and told by the people who lived them in front of a live audience at one of our ARC Stories events.
Next to him was a woman in a tiny yellow bikini clapping her behind and shrieking as she was tagged on the left cheek.
I'm Taylor Robinson, and today we have four stories where each of our storytellers are put in risky situations by some of their closest family members.
So the only thing that she could do to render any aid was to cross her arms under her bosom and lift it up out of the way, which meant that she had no view of what was going on below.
We created ARC Stories to give Birmingham a place to tell its stories to the world. So coming up after the news, Birmingham's own true stories. Welcome to ARC Stories Radio. I'm Taylor Robinson, ARC Stories Director, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Kinsley.
Today, we have four stories, each recorded throughout Birmingham at different ARC Stories events. They include one woman having to answer for the peculiar absence of her mother, another where a young girl and her father make an ill-fated attempt at producing their own honey, and a young man whose grandmother asks him to help her with a rather intimate problem.
In our first story, one young man is given a very important chore by his father while working on the family farm. It sounds simple enough until he meets his match in the form of a bad-tempered chicken. From an event we hosted earlier this month at the Birmingham Botanical Gardens where our theme was roots, stories about the nature of the South. Here's storyteller Jerry Robinson.
I was raised on a cotton farm in West Texas. In addition to the cotton, we raised horses and cattle and pigs and chickens and a pair of peacocks. In 1959, I was 8 years old, and my dad came to see me one day, and he said, "Jerry, I want you to start gathering the eggs every evening." I said, "Yes, sir," because that's what you said to my dad. So we start out to the hen house. Now, this is the way this chicken operation worked on this farm. We had 30 chickens and one rooster. The CEO, the CFO, the bouncer, and the man in charge was the rooster. The hens did all the work, but the rooster was in charge. He protected the hens, he protected the eggs. Every night before dark, he got them all in the hen house, and he was sitting at the door, and he was gonna kick the butt of anything that came in that hen house. So my dad comes in there, and he gets me, we get a little 3-gallon rusty milk bucket. We put some hay in the bottom of it, and he starts pulling the eggs out of the little bins where the chickens had put them. And I look up on the roost, and I noticed that rooster is pretty big, and he's agitated. He's taking exception to my dad taking the eggs. Now, you may not know anything about roosters, but chickens have got 3 toes that stick out the front, 1 toe that sticks out the back, and just above and inside of that toe that sticks out the back, they've got a spur, and it's got a very sharp claw on the end of it. And this rooster starts attacking my dad. And he's trying to kick my dad's butt because he's getting those eggs. And my dad would slap him back, and he'd start getting the eggs, and the chicken would come again and be hitting him with them spurs. He'd slap him back, and he'd get the eggs, and he'd come back and start getting him with those spurs. And finally, my dad just knocked the fire out of him. He bounced up against the wall, and we distracted him long enough to get the eggs and get out of there. So we start back to the house, and I come to the realization that tomorrow I gotta gather the eggs. My dad's 6'4", I'm 4 foot. That chicken came up to his knees, he came up to my waist. So I'm scared. The next day I go out there and I open up the chicken house just enough to see, and I can't see that sucker in there. So I open the door and I go in there at the bucket, and the sucker is hidden behind the other chickens. I got my back turned, and here he comes. He is wearing me out, and I'm kicking him and slapping him and gathering eggs, kicking him, slapping him, and he's spurring me on the leg. He scared me to death. He terrorized me every day. So later, I would go out there, and I'd open the door, and he wouldn't be in there, so I'd go in and I'd gather all the eggs. Then I'd start and I'd open the door back up to walk out, and that sucker's standing right there in front of me. He's either gonna get you coming or going, I'm telling you. And I would kick him, and he would spur me, and I'd kick him, and he'd spur me, and we went on like that forever. And the sorry sucker started attacking me at times when I was not getting the eggs. We lived 15 miles out in the country, and we had to ride a school bus to school every day. And somebody had to go out and watch for the school bus. The Kendricks' house was a mile and a half away, and when the bus got to the Kendricks' house, we started walking the 400 yards so we could get to where the bus picked us up. So somebody had to watch for the bus. Today, it was my day. I remember this. This is just like it was yesterday. If you saw the movie Jaws, y'all saw that movie. You could close your eyes and know when the shark was about to eat somebody because it's boom, 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 boom. That chicken had his own theme song. He would swell up his muscles and get his feathers out from his body, and he would shake his wings, and he would rustle those feathers together, and you could hear it for 50 yards, and you knew that it was about to happen. He's about to attack you. So I'm right out there in the middle of this big open space. He's twice as fast as I am, and I'm looking over to Kendrick's house for the bus, and that sounds, the rustling sound is right over here to my left. I am scared to death because I can't run. There's no place to go. So as I turn, the chicken had already started running at me. He's running real fast, and he's flapping his wings, and he's leaving the ground. And I turn, and like any good punter, I take a quick step with my left foot, point my toe. He gets about right there. I hit that sucker right in the middle of the chest, and the feathers go poof. He falls over to one side, and I make a beeline for the house, and we go get on the bus. On the way home that day, I said, this has gone on long enough. It's going to be me or the chicken. But I'm going to have to do something to hurt that chicken so he quits attacking me. So I devise, pretty good idea, I devise an ambush. We got this barnyard that's full of gravel. It is perfect, perfect chunking gravel. I know that because me and my little brother were having a rock fight, and he hit me right over the eye with one of them, and I got 4 stitches, and it's good gravel for a rock fight, I'm telling you. I get me a tow sack, and I put about 9 pounds of rocks in that tow sack. We got a haystack that's 20 feet wide, 50 feet long, and about 15 feet high, and it's right next to the horse barn. And I get up there on top of the haystack because every animal in the place walks up and down that area between the horse barn and the haystack. So I'm sitting up there, and I'm watching for him, and I keep watching for him, and he's tough, and I said, I'm gonna get him today. And I look at our red barn where we keep all of our grain and stuff, and the chickens are always in there eating that grain. And this rooster walks out of the red barn. He's a good-looking rooster. He is snow white. He's got that red thing on the top. He got that red thing here. He is a good-looking chicken, and he never walked a day in his life. Every day when he went someplace, it was a strut. He was walking. He was tough. They originated the phrase, cock of the walk, because of this chicken. He was conceited. I hated him. And he hated me. And I'm watching him, and he, sure enough, he takes a left. He's coming right down between the haystack and barn. And I'm at the strategic spot because He's going to get just about to me, and I'm going to get him with the rocks. And he can't go left because of the barn. He can't go right because of the haystack. The only way he can't go forward because that's where the rocks are going to be coming from. So he's going to have to exit out the back if he gets away. So I watch. He's coming. He's coming up there. And I, when he gets just the right spot, I unleash a barrage of rocks on this chicken. Never before ever seen anything like it. I'm throwing the rocks and I'm hitting him with about one or two every once in a while. And he's hurting and he's juking and he's jiving. He's trying to get away. He spins around. Finally, he gets all he can take and he takes out the back. I got one more handful and I chunk it at him. And one of them goes boom, right in the back of the head, forward flip, on his back, wings out, feet up, dead. The only chicken you got to have, I just killed. So I climb down off, the haystack, and I dump out all the rocks I got left. I stash the tow sack. I go to the house and watch the Three Stooges on TV. While I'm watching the Three Stooges, I realize that my dad is in the field plowing. He's going to bring that 730 John Deere tractor in, and he's going to park it not 30 feet from where that dead chicken is. I got three whipping from him in my entire 18 years that I lived with him. When he pulled his belt out, it wasn't a spanking, it was a reckoning. And I knew that if he saw the chicken and walked in and asked me, I was going to have to tell him what happened to the chicken. So I said, there's only one thing I got to do. I got to get rid of the evidence. So I go, boom, out the back door, and I'm out there between the barn and the haystack and right there where he is, and I look down, and sucker's gone. I say, no. We got this big boxer dog named Corky. Corky, he wouldn't chase a chicken, but he found a dead chicken. He was going to eat it. Anyway, I say, Corky's got the chicken. And I'm frantically looking for it because when Corky eats that chicken, there's going to be feathers in a 20-foot area. And the evidence is going to be there. So I'm looking for Corky, and I'm looking for the rooster, looking for Corky. I hop over into the horse corral, and I look around the corral. He's not there. I look in each of the stalls. He's not in there. I hop over the fence at the end, head toward the pig pens. And I look to my left, and all the chickens that we have are down behind our tin hay barn. And they are walking in this direction, and they are scratching and pecking just like chickens always do. And at the very back, a foot taller than all the other chickens, was the rooster. The chickens were walking toward me, and the rooster was walking behind them. He would take a step and stumble this way. He would take a step and stumble this way. And then he would stumble this way. So it wasn't a killing shot, but it was a pretty good shot. And in 4 or 5 days, he was back to normal again. But it turned out the ambush turned out to be a win-win situation for me. Because at the end, the rooster was still alive. And from that day on, he never ever bothered me again. He would still attack my dad. But if I walked into the barnyard and he saw me, he would go the other way. And from that night on, that day on, I was the cock of the walk.
For the money, two for the jack, three for the Joe, you got to pay back. I'm a stud green bantam rooster, looking for a fight. I'm looking for a fight.
Jerry Robinson is a retired high school football coach and biology teacher, and he also happens to be my father.
So how does it feel hearing your dad tell a story for us?
I love having him tell stories at our events. Both of my parents have been huge supporters of ARC Stories, but it means a ton to me because my personal love of storytelling began with me as a little boy listening to my father tell stories just like this one when I was growing up. So these stories have made a lasting impression on me, and I am so thrilled to get to share them with our audience.
Well, our next storyteller is also dealing with the lasting impression of one of her parents, but in this case, it proves to be extremely challenging for her. Find out what happens in a minute on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories.
This is ARC Stories Radio. We're bringing you true personal stories told live in front of an audience right here in Birmingham by people who live them. I'm ARC Stories director, Taylor Robinson.
And I'm media director, Chris Kinsley. Harper Lee famously wrote, "You can choose your friends, but you sure can't choose your family. And they're still kin to you no matter whether you acknowledge them or not." This next story is about learning when it comes to family, we're stuck with both the good and the bad. It's from an event we hosted last month at the Ramsey High School Theater, where our theme was rites of passage, coming of age stories. Here's storyteller Cece Lacy.
So I was about 8 years old when I realized that my mother does not operate on the same time spectrum as the rest of us. I was at my friend Lindsay's house one afternoon, and I had been waiting for hours for my mom to pick me up, and I was getting pretty anxious. I didn't know where she was, and so I was apologizing to Lindsay's mom for my own mom's tardiness, and she said, "Oh, Cece, don't worry, honey. We understand. She's on Tina time." Now, I was really appreciative of her understanding, but I was a little confused as to why no one had informed me about this Tina time. Needless to say, Tina time plagued most of my childhood. Often it meant getting picked up hours too late. Sometimes it meant getting dropped off hours early. Sometimes it meant we were in the middle of the grocery store and all of a sudden we just left the buggy in the middle of the aisle and left. Sometimes it meant we woke up on a Saturday morning and were on our way to Six Flags. The only constant was the unpredictability. And my siblings and I got used to it, but I can't say any of us enjoyed it. Tina time finally took its toll on me at my eighth grade graduation. It was late May 2004, and I was a scrawny, freckly 14-year-old who hated getting dressed up and hated being on stages. My mom decided that she wanted to help me get dressed and get ready for this momentous occasion. I wore my hair in a ponytail, as I still do today, but my mom insisted on blow-drying it for me and me wearing it down. She helped me get dressed in my little white polka-dotted dress with my white sandals and a little pearl necklace, and we are running very late. And so finally we get in the car, my mom's driving, and she's not dressed, she's not ready, my brother's not ready, but I'm ready, so at least we've got that. I get to school. I remember processing in, I remember walking up on the stage and finding my spot and sitting down and saying, "Okay, now I'm gonna see where my family is." Took a look out at the room. There was my dad and stepmom, my siblings, my grandparents. All right, where was my mom? Obviously, she wouldn't be on the front row because she was running late. She wasn't on the periphery. I didn't see her in the back. I just decided, oh, I probably won't be able to find her. It's pretty crowded in here. I'll see her after at the reception. A couple minutes later, I hear the big doors at the back of the auditorium squeak open. In comes my stepdad and my step-siblings. They went over to the back and found a spot back there. There's no mom. She did not come. I don't know why. I couldn't understand it. I wasn't upset that she didn't see me walk across the stage to grab a piece of paper. I was upset that, yet again, Tina time had caused a set of completely incomprehensible circumstances that allowed her to not show up. So we finished the ceremony, we recess out. I went down to the gym for a reception and was waiting for my family to come in, hoping maybe I'd just missed her and maybe she was there. She wasn't. So I went to go give my family a hug and tell them thank you for coming, but I could barely speak. My throat was welling up with that burning sensation of being on the onset of tears and just really wanting to hold it back. And still, I just could not understand how could she get me dressed, get me there, drop me off, but she couldn't make it herself. Thankfully, my family understood. They'd been dealing with Tina time for just as long as I had, so we left soon after they had gotten there. My dad and my stepmom were driving me home, profusely apologizing for her actions to no avail. And so they dropped me back off at my mom's house, and no one else was home yet. So I went upstairs, her door was closed. I got to my room, and there was a little note on my bed. So I went to go read it, and it said, "Peach pie, sorry, sweetie, very bad headache, we'll celebrate soon, XOXO mom." And I knew then at that moment exactly what I had to do. I had to break up with my mom. I wanted this to be a very undramatic breakup. I didn't want her to know that I was breaking up with her. I just wanted to kind of do it on my own. So I don't know if any of you have ever done that, but a one-sided breakup doesn't really go very well. I knew that I couldn't depend on her and didn't want to depend on her for moral support, emotional support, for helping me get places. I didn't want her to be a leading role in my life. I didn't really want her to have a part in my life at all. So I made those internal decisions and allowed her to continue living her life as if she believed that she was being my mother, fully well knowing that she wasn't. And so, of course, being on a one-sided breakup fills you with lots of anger and resentment, especially from 14 to 18. To say I was an angsty teenager is an understatement. I interacted with my mom, I knew she was there, but I also very much knew that she wasn't there. Like, she wasn't my mom, she was just this person in my life who had to be there. She created me, and I had to coexist with her, but I didn't want to let her in. I didn't want her to have that sacred role in my life. And so I made it through high school. I relied on my dad, my friends. I had a lot of other mother figures in my life who were filling in. All these people in my life, they knew the strained relationship that I had with my mom without me even saying it. So they filled in where they needed to. And this is really when I learned that the most important people in your life are the people who choose to be there and be in your life as much as you want to be in theirs. So I really relied on those people instead of my mom. Made it through high school, ready for college, summer of 2008, and I'm ready to embark on the world. And I didn't have a job or anything that summer, and I was really just getting ready to go to school, and I would often eat lunch with my dad. And so it was a sunny afternoon. I was meeting my dad from work, and we were over at O'Cars in Cahaba Heights. I'm not sure if it's there anymore, but I know we were sitting outside and having lunch. Could not tell you what we were talking about. Couldn't even tell you what I was eating. All I can tell you is that that is when I found out what Tina time actually is. My dad really haphazardly mentioned that my mom suffered from alcohol abuse, drug abuse, and bipolar disorder. Again, I was shocked. Why had no one told me this? How had I lived 18 years of my life with this person who was very ill and I didn't know any of it? And so I asked my dad, I said, how in the world did I not know this? He said, I don't know, how did you not know this? I was like, well, you didn't tell me, thanks. And all I could think of is why didn't you help her? Why did no one help her? And he said, well, when you were little, we helped her seek help a lot. She was in and out of facilities and she just didn't want to get better. So we stopped trying. And I said, well, look, can we try again? And I called my brother, my older brother, and I filled him in because he was also out of the loop. And I decided we had to do something. I decided that I couldn't be on this one side of this breakup knowing that she was suffering from so many things that, you know, she wasn't completely responsible for herself. She needed some help fixing them. So my brother and I decided we wanted to have an intervention, and we got our family together. We found a place that we thought she would like, and we did it. And we got her to go to a rehab facility. So typical addiction treatment is 90 days. She stayed for 50. This happened probably 5 or 6 more times over the next couple of years. She would get to a low place, we would suggest she go get help. She would go to a facility. She would decide she starts feeling better, and she would check herself out over and over and over again. So obviously, in trying to repair this non-relationship, it's really hard to watch somebody keep not wanting to help themselves. They get so close, and then they just have to start all over again. So we got more and more distant. I was always there when we needed to get her back into help, and I would write her letters when she was off at rehab, and we'd be as supportive as we can, but with this some distance, right? You have to protect yourself in all of this, so that's what I continued to do. And, you know, a couple of years ago, pretty much gave up hope of her getting better. I knew she would just continue living her life as it is without having a relationship with her four children and just going on as she was. Finally, last summer, we found the place that she needed to go to. She finally found that rock bottom that helped her decide that she needed to get help and wanted to get help and wanted to get better. And for the last 9 months, my mom has been living in an inpatient facility in Tennessee, finally getting treated for her underlying bipolar disorder that has caused all of this other disorder throughout her whole life. I went to visit her in January for her birthday, and it's the longest that we have spent time together since about 2009. And she's doing really well. And Tina time now is a measure of days of recovery and days of self-care. And although it might not be as mom, I'm starting to think and see that there's going to be a place for her in my life one day. And I would not have the patience or compassion or desire to even let her back into my life as she is now if I had not spent my life navigating Tina time. Thank you.
Got so many scratches and scars. Maybe they won't all go away, but they'll fade.
Cece Lacey is a program specialist with the Birmingham Education Foundation. You can find her on Facebook at Cece Lacey and learn more about the Ed Foundation at edbirmingham.org.
Now we go from a story about a woman's relationship with her mother to a story about a father's relationship with his daughter. She begins to see him as a hero who can do no wrong. But obviously, nobody's perfect, and he does a few things wrong with some painful consequences. It's from an event we hosted this month at the Birmingham Botanical Gardens, where our theme was roots, stories about the nature of the South. Here's storyteller Susan Smith.
The summer I was 6 years old, my father, who was a Presbyterian pastor, watched a National Geographic documentary about beekeeping and decided he wanted to become a beekeeper. So around Christmas that year, my mother and I drove to an apiary in Chilton County and bought a beehive. Christmas morning that year, Dad opened a 1977 edition of Garden Ways Practical Beekeeping and a jar of wildflower honey. Now, my dad is a self-taught beekeeper. He didn't have anyone looking over his shoulder to help him. He didn't even have any YouTube videos. But he did have Garden Ways Practical Beekeeping and a naive confidence that what generations of beekeepers before him had done, he would also be able to do. Despite his lack of experience, the hives did really well that spring and early summer. So by July 4th, Dad decided the time had come to harvest the honey. My mother fired up the oven for the brown bread recipe she had mastered, and we all prepared for a feast. Our next door neighbors, the Munchowers, also had big plans for that July 4th weekend. They had just installed a brand new swimming pool, and they had invited all of their friends and family over for a cookout. Just as Mr. Munchower was putting the burgers on the grill, my dad suited up and headed for the beehive. He built a small fire in his smoker, which is a stainless steel canister with an attached bellows and a funnel. And he took the top off the hive, and he put a little smoke on top of the bees inside. Now, smoke works to calm the bees, but it panics them first, because when the bees smell the smoke, they think that their hive is on fire. And because a hive cannot survive without its honey stores, they begin to gorge themselves on honey, and they forget all about the guy in the funny hat with his hands in their house. But my father neglected to put enough smoke in the hive. He didn't realize how much it would take to have that effect on the bees. And they started to be upset. Every bee in that hive realized they were being robbed. So my dad decided the best thing to do would be to move a little faster and get out. So he started brushing the bees off the honeycomb with his soft bristled bee brush. Well, every worker bee is a female, and the hive takes its personality from the queen. This particular queen suffered no thieves, and a buzzing cloud rose around my father's head. But because he had his bee suit on and his veil, my mother was the first one to get stung. And she jumped up from the quilt where we had been sitting and did the same squish face jig she does when she's been swimming and is trying to get the water out of her ear by slapping herself on the side of the head. By the time I realized what was happening, I had been stung on the arm, and I started making my way for the garage when my bare foot landed on a honeybee. At first, I had a funny, weird, warm feeling in the sole of my foot, but by the time it got to my knee, it was a white-hot, electric, throbbing ball of agony. My mother scooped me up, and we ran to the garage. As I was waiting on our screened-in porch for my mother to bring the meat tenderizer and the tweezers, I looked over to the Munchauer's yard and saw a man with no shirt and Madras shorts slapping his neck. Next to him was a woman in a tiny yellow bikini clapping her behind and shrieking as she was tagged on the left cheek. The flight of the Valkyries had begun, and the Munchauers ran for their garages, covering their bits of exposed flesh, trying to protect themselves from 100,000 angry ladies with 100,000 tiny spears. But despite this initial avian apocalypse, my dad did manage to get some honey from the girls that day. He brought the honeycomb into the garage and put the frames of honeycomb in the extractor, which is about a 3-foot-tall drum with a crank on the top and a spout on the bottom. Think about a stainless steel salad spinner for honey. As the honey ran out of the spout, I was supposed to hand my father clean jars, but soon I was putting my fingers and then my mouth under the spout of honey. Now, honey takes its flavor from the different nectars the bees use when they make it. So each batch has its own fingerprint of the place in which it was made, and each batch has its own unique vintage, which is delightful to distinguish. My first taste of raw, unpasteurized honey is something I will never forget. I could taste the wild privet. I could taste the pine tree. I could even taste the water from Bishop Creek. It was amazing. Later that afternoon, my dad went over to the Munchauer's house with a jar of honey to apologize. At first, they did not want to receive his apology, and they did not want to give him their forgiveness. But, my dad told me later, it's hard to stay mad at a guy who's trying to give you a jar of honey. Over the next few summers, my father had many opportunities to hone his beekeeping skills, and I became his right-hand man. I loved to work the bees with my dad, and I loved to do it barefoot, but I learned to be careful and not step on the girls. I had long hair that I liked to wear down, and I would often get a bee tangled in my hair, but my dad magically was able to untangle the bees from my hair and let them go without hurting them or getting either one of us stung. One time when we were working in the hive, my dad's hive tool slipped just a little bit and he uncapped a previously sealed cell of brood. And we were upset because we needed those new worker bees to keep the hive healthy. But right before our eyes, out of that cell he had just uncapped, flew a brand new worker bee. It was magical. One morning at church, one of Dad's few beekeeping friends came up to him and said that he was getting out of beekeeping and wondered if my father might like to have a hive that he hadn't robbed in a while and didn't plan to use. So Dad was delighted at the opportunity to have a hive for free. So he said yes. And I was so excited to go out with him and pick up this hive, but it was Sunday night and I had school on Monday, so my mother wouldn't let me go. And I was devastated. My disappointment resulted in a flood of tears, but my mother has never been one to cotton to my histrionics. So she said, "Susie, it'll be fine. He'll be back in an hour." And the hour came and an hour went, and then three and then four, and my father still hadn't returned. I fell asleep on the couch, but my mother stayed awake, imagining my father helpless in a ditch somewhere in Shelby County with a mask of honeybees on his face, unable to call for help. Finally, unable to stand the thought anymore, she woke me up and shuffled me out to the car to go and look for him. But before we could leave, his headlights appeared at the top of the driveway. When he opened the truck door and got out, he looked like a man who had been a few rounds with Evander Holyfield. His ears were swollen, his tongue was getting thick, his hands were blistered, his eyes were slits. He shuffled up to the kitchen and gave himself a shot of his emergency epinephrine and went to bed. My mother stayed awake for a few hours just to make sure he wasn't overcome by anaphylaxis in his sleep. It wasn't until the next morning that we learned what really had happened to my dad that night. As he had been lifting this hive into the bed of his truck, the rotten bottom board gave way, dumping 100,000 angry honeybees and several gallons of honey into the bed of his truck. He did eventually manage to leave the hive off a dirt road out by Oak Mountain State Park. But not until he had been harassed by both the Pelham Police Department and two petulant teenagers on a dirt bike. He had received several hundred stings. And it wasn't until later, maybe years later, that I realized the grave situation my father had been in that night. And to this day, I'm glad I didn't go with him. When he had been an inexperienced beekeeper, my dad told me later, he had been more concerned about the honey than about the hive. He was a man with a plan to impose. He wanted to bend the hive to his own will. But he learned that the secret to working honeybees is to be calm and go slow. They'll do almost anything you ask them to. You just have to ask. And that comes with maturity, Dad said. You learn not to force your own way, but to let yourself be adapted to the personality of each unique hive and her queen. My dad didn't have an agenda for me. I didn't have to perform for his friends to make him look good. I didn't have to get everything right. I had freedom to make mistakes and to find the mercy in those mistakes. He just let me be me. And I learned later that there were many times people from the church called my dad to tell on me for things they had seen me do. And I suspect for things they had thought or even hoped they had seen me do. But my dad didn't even tell me about it. He gave me room to be me. We moved away from the house where we had those first honey hives about 2 years later. And unfortunately, even though we took the hives with us, we lost them to disease or to flood about a year after we had moved. And the house was destroyed by a tornado, as was the Munchauer's house and many of the trees on the property. So even now, we can't go back to revisit that time in our lives. But this fall, my father and I are going to get in the truck. And we're gonna drive to an apiary in Chilton County and buy a beehive. I have three little children, two girls and a boy, who love to go barefoot in the summertime. My mother still has her recipe for brown bread, and I can't wait. Thank you.
Oh, my little honeybee, I'm so glad you saw me. You become my weed.
Susan Smith is a wife and a mother who loves to fly fish. You can get a glimpse into her life on Instagram at Somewhere Down South.
Family can so often put us in embarrassing or awkward scenarios, whether it's ruining the neighbor's barbecue with your honeybees or, in our next story, being called upon to do something you would never normally do. Hear just what that request is next on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's true stories told by the people who lived them and recorded in front of a live audience. I'm Media Director Chris Kinsley.
And I'm ARC Stories Director Taylor Robinson. Now, there is a good chance you have someone in your life for whom you would do anything. For our next storyteller, that person was his grandmother. But in this story, his love and devotion are definitely put to the test. It's from an event we hosted last year at the Avon Theater where our theme was On the Clock, Stories from the Workplace. Here's storyteller Leonard Lee Smith.
There is an old trick that public speakers use to overcome their nerves and stage fright. It is to imagine the audience in their underwear. Now, before your mind goes down a dirty little path, I'm speaking strictly in a professional sense. You see, I used to be paid to dress and undress people. I had a career as a professional costumer and wardrobe master. Every afternoon, a few hours before the curtain went up, I assisted members of the cast in getting dressed. I spent my evenings cinching up corsets, tucking up chins, fluffing up wigs, padding down bosoms, gluing on prosthetics, and mounting up bustles. It was a very busy time. Needless to say, I saw a large number of people every day in various states of undress. My job combined the skills of a professional laundry person and a dungeon master. Now, you wonder what would prepare a person for such a career. You see, it all started one summer in central Alabama. My brother and several of my cousins and I had stayed the night with our granny Ruby. We were to go the next day to a church homecoming in Banks, Alabama, an hour and a half away. We were to be our grandmother's cast, crew, and production. She was going to show us off. We spent Saturday getting our hair cut, pressing our clothes, and polishing our shoes. Now, not only was she going to show off via her grandchildren, but she was also going to show off her cooking skills. So Sunday morning, as the rest of us got ready, she was in the kitchen finishing up the food, packing it and wrapping it, and getting us ready to go. She was the last to go and get dressed. As we were milling around in the living room, I heard her whoop. Now, this is what my grandmother did when she needed your attention. Whoo, anybody out there? Now, generally, my grandfather would have answered this call, but he was conveniently absent. He was nowhere to be found. So a few moments later, she whooped a second time. Woo, anybody out there? And I went down the hall to investigate. So I knocked on the door and said, Granny, did you need something? Yeah, darling, get in here. I need your help. My 13 years of life had not prepared me for what I opened the door to. There stood my grandmother in an advanced state of underdress. She had on her shoes and her stockings. She didn't wear pantyhose, she wore stockings. She had on her panties and she had on her brassiere. She didn't call it a bra, she called it a brassiere. And somewhere between her knees and her hips, she had a girdle that was really too small for her to put on. Now, for those of you who are not old enough to know what I'm talking about, I am not referring to a Spanx. This garment was not made of Lycra. This garment was made of a fabric called cotille. It is fortified and rigid and milled to have no bias. It had stitched reinforced panels on the front and stitched reinforced panels on the back. The only place the garment had any give was along narrow elastic seams down the side. It had hook and eye closures and garter straps off of the bottom. This was not clothing, this was architecture. It would stand up on its own in the corner. I recovered from my shock and awe, and she said, "Honey, help me get this girdle on." So I went and grabbed a side of the girdle and began to pull. Well, I just managed to bounce her all over the bedroom. Not much happened. Finally, I said, "Granny, we can't do this by ourselves. We need help." So I went down the hall to retrieve my cousin, who was also 12 or 13, and I said, I need you to help me. He said, "What are we doing? I can't explain. Just follow me." So he opened the bedroom door to much the same shock and awe that I had had, and we commenced to attack this garment a second time. Now, there was another problem. Not only was my grandmother short and stout, but she was an unusually full-bosomed woman. And she was into her 70s and had had 6 children. So her figure had become, how shall we say, pendulous. So the only thing that she could do to render any aid was to cross her arms under her bosom and lift it up out of the way. Which meant that she had no view of what was going on below and could offer no assistance. We were on our own with this device. So we bounced her all over the bedroom a little while longer, and we had managed to get the girdle sort of somewhere from between her knees and her hips to closer to her hips. And finally, my cousin got the idea that perhaps gravity could be made into our ally. That if we could grab 4 points on the girdle and lift her and the girdle completely off of the ground, that gravity might pull her down into it. So we grabbed our points on the girdle, and we put our feet shoulder-width apart in batting stance because we figured this would be kind of an athletic maneuver. And on the count of 3, we lifted. Well, her eyes widened and she pitched forward, and we thought she was going to tip over at first. And then she had to fling her arms out for balance and her bosom fell. And it was just sort of this explosion of flesh. But despite the catastrophe, we held on. And when the smoke cleared, she had sort of gone down into it. Well, it looked like a skin on a sausage. She had asked for no further assistance, and we beat a hasty retreat. A few moments later, she came out of the bedroom, and I remember looking at her and thinking, heaven help her, if that girdle blows, she'll bust every seam in that dress. Well, finally, we arrived in Banks to the little church, and all of my grandmother's classmates were there to show off their grandchildren and their cooking. And I noticed that my grandmother sat ramrod straight and she wasn't breathing very deeply. And when we would stand for the hymn, she wouldn't sing. She would grab herself under her bosom and begin this strange little shimmy, trying to maneuver that garment into place a little better. And I noticed that all of the women in the church her age were doing much the same thing. And I remember thinking, God bless them, they must be uncomfortable. And heaven help any of them if they have a heart attack when the paramedics showed up. By the time they got them undressed, they'd be dead. Well, we finished the service and we ate a lot of food. We visited with a lot of people. Finally, it was over and we headed back home. We got home and my grandfather changed out of his clothes and settled into his easy chair for an afternoon of sports. And my grandmother went down the hallway and I remember thinking, I need to make myself scarce in case she needs help out of that thing. So we all went into the living room with my grandfather to watch TV, but my grandmother didn't join us. She came out in a house dress, and she went immediately into the kitchen and began laying all of her recipes out on the table. I went to investigate what she was doing. I said, "Granny, what's going on?" She said, "Oh, sugar, this is a big week. Not only did I have church homecoming, but this Wednesday I'm hosting the Women's Missionary Union Steering Committee over here for luncheon, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to fix." And I remember thinking to myself, "Well, I hope you find something to prepare, but Wednesday, when you got to fortify yourself for those ladies, I ain't going to be here when you get that girdle on."
Leonard Lee Smith is both a hairdresser and professional storyteller. He's also one of our story coaches here at ARC Stories. You can learn more about him at his website, llsmithstoryteller.com.
If you like stories about family bonds, we'd love to have you join us for our next live event. It's coming up on Saturday, May 13th at the Avon Theater. Our theme for the night will be Word to Your Mother, stories about moms. Now, that's the day before Mother's Day, so you can get tickets for you and your mom and all the other info that you might want on our website, arcstories.com.
Thanks for listening to ARC Stories Radio. We produce this program in partnership with WBHM. We especially need to thank Michael Crow, Program Director at WBHM, who is vital to making this show a reality. The original idea for an ARC Stories radio show goes to WBHM's Director of Community Engagement, Audrey Atkins, and Membership Manager, Will Dahlberg. The news director for WBHM is Gigi Duban, and engineering support comes from Daryl McCullough. The general manager for WBHM is Chuck Holmes. This month, we especially need to thank WBHM's Andrew Yeager for making the show happen. Recording and mastering is by Eric Chapman from Symmetric Sound. Upper Air Creative does all of our design. If you like today's stories, please subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on our website, arcstories.com. There you can listen to other stories, stay up to date with all of our events, and even submit your own story to tell. After all, we're always asking, what's your story?